There we go. Excellent. I'm going to bring this back up. I'm sorry. I'm 2 weeks out on this, and so I'm getting back into all the technology. So, Derek and everybody, we've been going through a study through the Old Testament, and we have started at the beginning, and we did an overview of basically every book of the Bible. Come on in, guys. Come on in, Steve. There. Hey, Mark. How you doing, my man? Good to see you guys. Good. Good. Come on in. Come on in.
Go ahead.
It was crazy. It was just up and down.
Okay,
and
everything.
I don't know. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I couldn't get in, and then
I ended up getting your text later.
There.
I was like, ah, no.
Yeah,
it was later. It was later when I got him.
Oh, it's like 7:20. I finally got in there. I was the only one there. So.
No, no, I'm glad you're here tonight, bro. Grab a seat, my man. So you guys want to give Mark one of those
sure,
things there?
I gave to Steve.
Oh, gave to Steve. Yeah.
To pass out.
It was all for me.
Why do you want me to pass out?
No, that's not nice.
You don't want me to pass out. No.
Oh, here's another one.
Well, we've been going through the Old Testament, and the first week we did an overview of pretty much everything in the Old Testament, given just a really broad overview. And then the second week we did a chronological view. You guys remember that, where we kind of put every book of the Old Testament in its proper order. You know what I mean? Because our English Bibles, they're not really in the proper order. They're kind of sectional. You have the poetic books, you have the Pentateuch, you have a lot of these other. And by the way, Derek, I have all the notes for the class. I can print all those out for you if you'd like them. Anybody online, or if you guys would like any of my stuff, I can get that to you.
I missed 2 weeks ago. I would love to catch if you have that.
I would definitely get it for you there, Steve. Absolutely, 100%. And so then we went through Genesis, and we basically did a real overview, a gigantic, real fast, drinking from the fire hose overview of Genesis. And then last week I recorded my lesson. I don't know did any of you guys catch the recorded lesson online?
No.
Okay, well, that's okay. You guys can go back and do it. I did it on purpose that way because it was a study of the life of Abraham and why he is important and in regard to New Testament and our salvation and these kind of things. But go back online and find it. It's on sermon audio. I can send you guys the links. Maybe we'll watch it on Friday. That'll be good.
Is it on Facebook?
It's on Facebook, yep. It is on Facebook, and it's also on our website. You can find it.
Okay.
It's the life and importance of Abraham.
Okay, cool.
And so, but tonight we're going to keep rolling with our study, moving on into the book of Exodus, an overview of Exodus. Now, I just want to make a comment that some of my notes are taken from a couple of different things here, and these are just recommendations. First and foremost, MacArthur's Bible commentary, which is an excellent, very inexpensive Bible commentary if you're looking for a really good one that goes through the entire Bible. You know, you can sometimes find this on Christian book.
John MacArthur,
yep. You can sometimes get it for like $10 online. I mean, it's super cheap for a big old book like this that has a lot of information. So some of my notes are, I purposely take my notes from things that, from in places where are easily accessible for people. So we got that one, and then also you can download this one actually on your phone if you have it, the Reformation Study Bible, which is the study Bible that I kind of I recommend.
What is it?
Reformation Study Bible, and it's by R.C. Sproul, and it's a great study Bible.
Sproul, okay.
Yep. John MacArthur, R.C. Sproul, those are two of the best. And then also final book that I'm kind of relying on too is this book right here, which is called The Message of the Old Testament, which is by Mark Dever, who's a great pastor down in Washington, D.C. And so I really recommend that if you'd like to take a look at those. You guys can take a look at them afterwards, or anybody online or whatever. But so let's roll. So first and foremost, the title. We got to talk about that. The English title Exodus, it comes from the title is given in the Septuagint translation. Anybody know what the Septuagint is? What's the Septuagint?
That's the Greek Testament.
It's the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. It would have been the translation that Jesus would have been using. Okay, and so because Jesus would have read from that, and so it comes from the Septuagint as well as the Latin Vulgate translations of the Old Testament, and that's mainly because of the main theme of the book, which is the departure of Israel from Egypt being the main focal point. The nation of Israel, who had come under slavery as a result of a lot of different things. You recall the last time we were in Genesis, Joseph was a overseer in Pharaoh's court. And so his descendants had basically resided in Egypt. And so over time, over 400 years or so, they had eventually come under dire circumstances. They became slaves. And so what this book records for us is their exodus, their departure from that oppressive nation. In Hebrew Bible, the opening words of the book, it says, and these are the names. That's literally what the original title was called, and these are the names. It was the original title of the book, which in Hebrew is a long Hebrew word, which I won't try to pronounce tonight. But with the implication in the language, this book being a continuation or a sequel to the book of Exodus. Okay. Now, we looked at this at the beginning. How many books did Moses write?
Five.
And what do we call those books?
The
Pentateuch. That's right. So this book would have been written by Moses, which brings us to point number two, the author, background, and setting. Moses' authorship is unquestionably the thing, okay? Unquestionably the consensus by theologians and historians. Everybody, in other words, believes that Moses is the author, okay? Very, very rare that you're going to find somebody that believes that it was a different author. Moses actually claims authorship in chapter 24, verse 4, where Moses wrote down all of the words of the Lord. And then also other Old Testament books affirm Moses' authorship. You can see those on your sheet, Joshua, Kings, Daniel, Malachi. And then even in the New Testament, you can find different places where even the New Testament writers affirm that it was Moses who wrote this book. So that's who it was, almost for sure. Exodus takes place during the 18th dynasty of Egypt, which was a very well-known and well-recorded period of ancient history. And I bring that up because many times when people want to attack the Bible or attack its authenticity, oftentimes they go back and say, well, none of it is recorded in history. None of it is actually confirmed, actually happened in history. Well, that's not entirely the case. You can actually go back during this 18th dynasty of Egypt. And it's funny in this particular case that there are according to those histories, there's like these blotches of history that are not recorded for us, which just so happens to be this time, which again, it was well known that whenever there was any kind of embarrassment to a pharaoh or a king of Egypt or anything along those lines, that they wouldn't record it. And so you have these big blotches of history that kind of refer back to it in like one sentence. And so that's kind of what we have here, but nonetheless, it's there. Pharaoh Thutmose III was one of the kings of Egypt during this time of their history and was known as the Napoleon of the ancient Egypt, who was known for having expanded Egypt's boundaries and influences or an influence far beyond its natural borders. At this time, Egypt was known for its military might, having previous to Thutmose's reign expelled the Hyksos kings from their land, which again was a rival nation to Egypt, and redirecting the country's economic, military, and diplomatic growth under Pharaoh Amos the first reign. And thus, Egypt was a very strong superpower at the time. You have to understand that throughout history, especially during the time of Moses, that Egypt was just a massive might. Their military was bar none the best. They were like the United States of the time. Nobody messed with Egypt. Nobody messed with Egypt, and they would go in and conquer lands and just continually expand their borders. The pharaoh was regarded as a god. That goes back even to their recordings of history because
they always recognize their kings as gods.
As gods, exactly. And so, but the point is that this is the setting that this is written in. It's written in a time when Egypt was the power of the world. Everybody looked to Egypt. That's when Moses was writing. Moses himself, who wrote the book, was born in 1525 BC, and became learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, according to Acts 7:22. Having grown up, of course, in the courts of Pharaoh Thutmose the First and Second, as Queen Hatshepsut as well as Queen Hatshepsut for the first 40 years of his life. So he, again, we'll go through this in just a second, the life of Moses, but Moses, of course, was an Israelite who, because of the infant side of who would be Pharaoh Thutmose the First, had called for the death of all the firstborn babies, and so the mother, rather than obeying that, put him in the little ark and sent him down the river, and he was caught in the reeds, and Pharaoh's daughter at that time ended up finding Moses and taking him in as his own. And so Moses would have spent and become a student under the Egyptian reign at that particular time. But we'll talk about his life in a second. After his self-imposed exile for another 40 years under Thutmose III, Moses returned to Egypt under God's direction to be Israel's leader during the reign of Anahatet. I always mispronounce that, the second, the Pharaoh during the actual Exodus. That was, he would have been a new Pharaoh. He would have been a young Pharaoh, probably in his 20s, a real young, arrogant type guy. And so being that Moses grew up under, in Egypt, in the king's court, in the Pharaoh's court, God used both the educational system of Egypt and Moses' exile to prepare Moses to represent his people before this powerful king, and to guide his people through the wilderness of Sinai during his final 40 years of life. Moses would die on Mount Nebo when he was 120 years old. We can read that in the end of Deuteronomy chapter 34, verses 1 to 6. And we'll talk about that more when we get to Deuteronomy. But and that was as a result of God's judgment on him for being very angry and disrespectful towards him. And we'll talk about that. God's repercussions and chastisement for sins, even in this life. We'll talk about that more when we get there. But Moses would have to look down or look on from afar from the mountain as the rest of the Israelites entered the promised land without him. And that would be the end of his life until Matthew chapter 17, verse 3, when Moses makes a sudden reappearance. I know you can look at your thing. Where did Moses all of a sudden reappear? At the Transfiguration, right? Oh, yeah, really? Where were you guys?
At the Wednesday morning.
Oh, the Wednesday morning, okay. Where are you guys right now?
Well, Steve is, Pastor Steve is gone, so you know Glenn, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Glenn led, and he was, he did a little thing on the name of the Lord, and of course, he gets
it. Yehovah, that's how he pronounces it. Yehovah, I disagree with him on that. I don't think that it's pronounced that way. But that's, oh yeah, no, I don't think so. But we can get into that another time.
Okay.
We'll talk about the names of the Lord at another time, but I disagree with him on that. I think Yehovah is not the proper way. But anyway, but no, that's good that you guys are going through it. Yeah,
I wonder, I know it's a little bit off track, but Moses grew up in Pharaoh's court, and then he went back to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." Does that Pharaoh know who Moses was? They used to be in the court of Pharaoh?
He probably didn't because again, there was a big uprising in between the pharaohs at that particular time. He may have heard his name, but he certainly didn't have the respect that
I watched the movie where they grew up together.
Right.
And then eventually Moses left and he became pharaoh. So when he went back to see the pharaoh again, he knew who Moses was because they grew up together.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's probably not true then, right?
Well, that's definitely an inference. That's definitely Hollywood. I mean, a lot of... Well, you know, the thing is that, I mean, it's like going to see a thing down. Have any of you guys ever been to Sight and Sound down in Lancaster?
No.
Have you been on Sight and Sound? You know what I'm talking about, man. You know, they take artistic license sometimes, and which is fine, you know, but as long as they...
It's not biblical.
It's not biblical, but
yeah.
Sometimes, I mean, even as a pastor sometimes, but yeah.
Like Moses we were talking about, so I was wondering if the Pharaoh, he went back and said, let my people go, knew that he was... Moses, and he used to be in the court of Pharaoh. You know?
It's a possibility, but the Bible doesn't really expand on that, so we really don't know. I mean, my personal opinion is that there was so much infighting amongst the pharaohs at the time, and so many power grabs that it really could have been.
Yeah. Dude,
number of years went by between
right.
the time he left.
It was 40 years. It was 40 years.
Between the time he left and came back again.
Right, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he was in Midian for 40 years.
Wow.
And so
that was
yeah, it was. He was 40 when he left, and then he was 80 when he returned.
And the burning question was 80?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was
wow.
80 years old, yep. And so we'll talk about that in a second. Let's keep moving so that we can get through. But historical and theological themes, I just got to bring this up again. The Exodus marked the end of the period of oppression for Abraham's descendants and the beginning of the fulfillment of the covenant promises to Abraham and his physical descendants. And when I say physical descendants, I'm talking about national Israel. We've talked about that before, the difference between national Israel and spiritual Israel. We're going to continue to make that point. Yeah, go ahead there, Steve.
Oh, no, I'm just...
Okay, all right, I didn't know if you... But he made this promise that they would not only reside in the promised land, the actual physical promised land, but that they would also multiply and become a great nation. Genesis 15:13, God made this promise. Then the Lord said to Abram, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs and will be a servant there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. So Abraham knew of the oppression that Egypt was going to put on the physical descendants. It was prophesied. He knew of this. This was going to happen. Then Genesis 12, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abraham," or Abram, "go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land." Is somebody online asking a question? Okay, all right. I thought somebody was talking. "In your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So you see the promises that were made to Abraham and his offspring. And we see the fulfillment of those in Exodus. We see the fulfillment of that there. And so continuing on, after the departure from Egypt, at Mount Sinai in the plains of Moab, God would also give Israel his law, and they would need for living properly in the promised land of Israel as the theocratic people of God. By this, they were to be different or distinct from other nations. Deuteronomy 4 says this. It says, "For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him?" Well, there's no other God, right? That's the answer to that question. "And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you this day?" There's nothing like the law of God. There's nothing like what God gave to Moses and brought down from Sinai. We still base our own legal structure on it. That's how foundational it is. Romans 9 says this, speaking of the Israelites' distinction and place, the actual, you know, in actual, you know, world history. Paul said this: "They are Israelites, and to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ, who is God over all, blessed forever. Amen." And so they are a blessed people. Amen. I mean, to be a national, you know, racially Jewish person is a blessing. Because why? Because you have been given so much of God's promises and all of these different things. Now, can I ask a question? Is being Jewish, does that make you automatically saved?
No.
What saves us?
Grace.
Right. God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ alone. So just because you are ethnically Jewish doesn't mean that you're automatically going to heaven, right? Right. And we need to make that very distinct. While they are a chosen people of God, and while they have been given so many blessings, they just being Jewish doesn't mean that they're automatically saved. Okay? They still need to put their faith in Jesus Christ, just like all of us. We've talked about that before, so
I think the word definitely to tie in here would be exemption.
Right. Why is that?
Are they exempt? You know what I mean? Because just because they have all of these promises of power and stuff, they think they're exempt in some way.
Right, and that's not true.
Spared from the second death.
Right, and that's where we need to make a distinction between, and we'll talk about this later, God's physical people and God's spiritual people. Because, they were God's chosen people physically, but there is a chosen people, spiritual people, who are not made up by race. They are actually made up of every tribe, tongue, and nation. Every race is is in the family of God through Jesus Christ. We are one race in Christ. Not, you know, and again, this is where we need to make that distinction, but very important. But let's keep going. Outline of the book. I'm going to fly through this, okay? So because I want us to be able to pray tonight too. So I'm just going to kind of give us the bullet points. I give you all of this information because I want you guys to be able to have, if you read through Exodus, and I would encourage you to do it. You could do it in a day or so. You know what I mean? Even if you're not a quick reader, it's not that long of a book. But I want you to be able to have a basic outline of the book so that you can be like, okay, well, what happened when? What's the order? And so make sure to keep that paper and go back and use it as a reference when you go through some of your study Bibles. Derek, I noticed you guys both have that ESV study Bible. That's a really good study Bible, and it's actually going to have a lot of notes in it. And I actually based this outline. I did my own outline. This is my own, but I based it kind of on this study Bible over here, but it's going to be very similar. So that's a good Bible to have. But keep that in your Bible, and you can compare and contrast. But so first and foremost, the book opens from chapter 1 to chapter 15 with God's deliverance of his people, namely the Exodus. That's what it records for us, the first 15 chapters. Now, it's a 40-chapter book. So really, it's the Exodus is really the only like the first like third of it, you know what I mean? Like first quarter of it. And so you can see it goes down through here. God, what happened right there in letter A, Israel increases greatly in Egypt, meaning that they were fruitful and they multiplied. Because, you know, you had Joseph, and then from that 400 years on, it developed an entire race of people from Joseph's line, from you know, Isaac and all these other ones. And so they feared them, but so they put them under oppression. That's what letter B is. Pharaoh oppresses Israel. And then towards the end of that 400 years, you have the birth of Moses. As I spoke about before, Moses flees to Midian after killing the Egyptian. And so, because what happens is again, he was raised as an Egyptian, but he still knew that he was Jewish by blood. And so one day he saw an Egyptian oppressing a Jewish man and, you know, basically beating on him. And Moses went and intervened, killed the guy. And somebody saw him do it. And so he was confronted about it. And that is what caused him to flee to Midian outside of Egypt for 40 years. And so to answer your question, Steve, yeah, he was there in Midian in chapter 2 there for 40 years. Okay. And so God hears Israel's groanings in chapter 2, and because obviously they're under oppression. God speaks to Moses there at the end of the 40 years through the burning bush and says, listen, I need you to go back into Egypt, and I'm gonna empower you. And then what does he do to prove that? Well, God gives him these miraculous signs. He's able to stick his hand in his jacket, pull it out, and he's got leprosy. And then he puts it back in his jacket, and he's clean again. You know what I mean? And he basically says to him, look, I'm going to empower you. You don't have to worry about this. I'm going to be the one that sovereignly works and ordains so that you can, because he doubted himself. I mean, Moses was slow of speech. That's what he said. He didn't really want to go back to Egypt. He didn't want any of that. He was very timid about it. But God empowered him and gave him those miraculous signs. And so letter H, Moses returns to Egypt, but Pharaoh's oppression increases. And he forces them to make bricks without straw, which, again, you know, back in that day, to make bricks, you needed straw in order to make bricks. Again, I don't know of the exact way in which they made bricks and how they needed straw and all that stuff, but you needed straw to make the bricks. And that was kind of the last straw, before God worked here. So God promises to fulfill his covenant promise made to Abraham. Because you remember back when we talked through Genesis and why I said that Genesis was such an important book, because it lays the foundation for everything else. God made a promise to Abraham. He said, look, you're going to have people, and they are going to be as the stars in heaven. They are going to be as numerous as the sand on the seashore, right? And God is going to fulfill that. And yet here his people was, you know what I mean? They're under oppression, being oppressed in slavery by this Pharaoh, by this king. And so it seemed like God was going to renege on his promise. But what God does, and he does this continually throughout the Pentateuch especially, is he reiterates this promise that he made specifically to Abraham, that covenant that he made, and that he would save his people. That's very important for you to keep in mind. You then have the genealogies of Moses and Aaron, which is very important. Moses goes before Pharaoh and warns of the plagues. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not familiar with Aaron. How is he? Is he related to Moses somehow?
Yeah, he was. He was his cousin, I believe. Or what? Yeah, brother. I'm sorry. Yes, Aaron was his brother.
Oh.
And so Aaron would end up. Yeah. What's that?
His sister Miriam.
Yes, and they would actually end up later on in the book. In I believe it's in either in Deuteronomy or Numbers, I believe, I forget what the book is, but they would sin against God, and they too would not be allowed to go into the promised land. Miriam would actually die. Aaron would die up on the mountain, and you don't really hear of him ever again.
Was that the gold cap?
That was the reason. That was the reason, which we'll get to. But getting back, you know, did that answer your question, brother?
For some reason, I don't remember reading about Aaron. That's why I was wondering how he really comes to the
right.
But he didn't go into the promised land either.
No, he didn't. No, he did.
Joshua did, right?
Joshua did. And but no, he would not go into the promised land.
They were biological brothers, though?
Yes.
Oh.
Yep.
Which actually is interesting because you think Moses was thrown in the river. Wonder how Aaron managed.
Right. different Pharaoh, different time.
Just enough time between them.
Right. So basically Moses goes before Pharaoh and warns him. He says, listen, you're going to let us go. Otherwise, God's wrath is going to come down upon you. And this is an interesting thing, and again, I'm kind of done with my time here, so we might have to come back to this next week. But he gives this warning of the plagues. And yet, you read throughout the book of Exodus, God's sovereignty even over the heart of Pharaoh. Pharaoh hardens his heart, but then God hardens Pharaoh's heart. God sovereignly works. So you have to ask yourself a question, like, What is going on here? Why did God have to harden Pharaoh's heart? Well, it's because ultimately what God wanted to do is he wanted to break off every single connection between Israel and this pagan nation. And that's what every single one of these plagues, I'll get into it more next week. We'll talk about the plagues specifically. I was kind of wondering where I was going to end tonight. And so every one of the plagues that are listed here, the water being turned into blood, the frogs, the gnats, you can keep going down through the list, the livestock dying, the boils, the hail, darkness. Every one of those plagues attacked one piece of Egyptian culture.
Interesting.
Like, for instance, okay, the water turned to blood. They worshipped the River Nile. And they had this, it was part of their culture, it was part of their their sacrifices and these kind of things that they did, that they couldn't get blood on their hands, and that to get blood on their hands or to have it on themselves or to be on anything to, you know, it was immensely gross, and it made them unclean. It actually made them unfit for the afterlife. And so they had to go through this big ceremonial thing. So what did he do? God turned the very water that they need to wash in and drink from to blood. To attack them and to attack their culture.
That had to give someone a bad day.
Oh, you know, it definitely did. It gave them a very bad day. Frogs. They were abhorred in their culture. We'll go through every one of these. I mean, going down through darkness, all the way to the darkness, right? Who did they worship? Ra.
Yes.
Ra is the sun god, right? Ra.
Yes. Yes.
So he went from all these smaller gods to the God. And then finally, what was the final plague?
Death
of the firstborn. You ever wonder why that was? Well, the death of the firstborn, you got to remember this, is that your posterity, your children, according to Egyptian culture, was your ticket to the afterlife. You needed to have sons and daughters, and lots of them, in order for you to be taken care of in the afterlife. This is the reason behind why they didn't just bury you in the ground. What did they do for pharaohs?
Mummy.
They mummify you, and they put you where? They put you into a pyramid, right? And so what you would do is your offspring would go into the pyramids periodically and bring food offerings and different things that the pharaohs liked during their lives. And that was supposed to be able to give them some kind of, you know, help in the afterlife. Because according to their religion, if your posterity didn't bring you food, you would die in the afterlife. You would actually essentially go to hell, their version of hell, in the afterlife. So you needed your posterity to come and bring food. You needed your children to come and bring you food. If they didn't bring them something to do in the afterlife, if they didn't, let's just say, I'm just throwing it out there, maybe they like to play chess. Yeah, chess probably wasn't around back then, but they like to play chess. They literally bring something in, like a chessboard, and put it in the pyramid with them so that they could play chess in their minds. They could play chess in the afterlife. Otherwise, they would be bored in the afterlife. Yeah, you could feed them, but what are they going to do in the afterlife? This was their mentality. And so to kill the firstborn, and that was the job of the firstborn, by the way, to kill the firstborn was basically to kill any hope that they had for the afterlife. Do you see? Do you see how God was attacking every single one of their gods and their things and that they believed in? And that's why the Passover is so important. But listen, I am right now, we need to pray because I want to make sure that we get to prayer tonight, okay? Real quick, I'm going to stop right there. We'll pick up where I left off. Any questions?
No. One very quick question. And Joseph, his brothers came to Egypt.
Yeah.
I think there was a famine, I believe, and they came to,
yep,
to Egypt. He revealed he was Joseph, and that's the end of Genesis, you know?
Right.
And then the beginning of Exodus, they've been enslaved for 400 years.
Right.
I'm curious, at the time of Joseph, they were his family, and they were welcomed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious as to how they became slaves and how much time passed before they became slaves.
They were threatened. Overturn things and take over.
Right, exactly.
Joseph himself was a slave.
Grab your Bible really quick. Turn with me really quick to just chapter 1, the first couple verses, just real quick. I'll answer that question.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It seems like I remember something about overpopulation.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Yeah. He said in chapter 1, Exodus 1, verse 1, it says, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all the brothers and all the generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly, and they multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now, verse 8, notice. Now, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph.
Okay, I'm remembering this now.
You see that?
Yes.
And he said to his people, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land. And therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. And so they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves.
Yeah, I simply forgot.
Right.
A lot of this is coming back to memory.
Right, absolutely. And so, yeah, basically what happened was is that there was a pharaoh that arose that didn't know Joseph and didn't really care about him.
Right.
Got threatened, and that's what they did.
How many times has that happened in history where
it happens all the time?
Threatened and they, you know. Yeah.
Absolutely. Happens all the time. Any other questions, sir? Thoughts on that? Well, actually, my game plan was actually, if we got a little bit further, next week I think we'll talk more about the actual plagues in a little bit deeper detail. But what I wanted to do, and we're going to do in a couple weeks, is we're going to take a look at, because what the second half of the book kind of details is the building of the tabernacle itself. And I'm going to talk about that, the Ark of the Covenant and its significance and how it was built and these kind of things. Matter of fact, one of the things I was going to surprise you, but there's this place out in Pennsylvania that actually, it's right in Lancaster, as a matter of fact, that is a full-size replica, scaled replica of the actual tabernacle that you can go and visit.
Really?
So if you are in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, make sure you look that up and go there and go check it out. It's really, really good. But while I was there, I ended up picking up this model, this like little model that you can put together of the tabernacle. And me and my little daughter, we put it together. Well, I did it most of the day, but we put it all together. I'm going to bring that in. I'm going to show you guys.
Oh, that's very cool.
And so we'll take a look at the Ark of the Covenant, what was in it, and why it was so significant and these kind of things, and get into why that's important. So we'll probably be in Exodus for a couple weeks.
That'll be great.
So. That's awesome. But sound good?
Yes.
All right. Awesome. Awesome.